From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a Syrian filmmaker documented 5 years of her life in the midst of a civil war and made a film as a love letter to her daughter. Then cinematographer Robert Richardson brings 1969 LA to the screen and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. How does he find compromise with his longtime collaborator, director Quentin Tarantino?
Well, there actually is no middle ground with Quentin Tarantino. It is Quentin, or it is not.
And Michael McDonald sang lead with the Doobie Brothers and a whole lot of other gigs doing background vocals. All that coming up on The Frame.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
Wad Al-Khatib started filming Everything at the start of Syria's civil war in 2012. Her courtship and marriage to her husband Hamza, the devastation and carnage caused by bombings, and her pregnancy and birth of her daughter, Sama. Wad worked with fellow director Edward Watts to make the documentary for Sama. Both directors and Wad's husband, Hamza, joined us in studio. And we started by talking about what it was like to be a refugee and leave home, a moment that Wad taped in her beloved garden.
I can't believe that I couldn't come again. No words can describe what I'm feeling now. We don't want to. Forced to flee out of our city.
You should know that every refugee has a story. Every story it's bring a lot of memories about a lot of life, a lot of dreams. When we were like 16, 17, we've never dreamed that we want to be a refugee in another country. All our dreams was about Syria and in Syria. And still until now, every person around the world living new life, we are very grateful about this life, of course, because it's safe. But also all our dreams, every night when we see everything, it's all about Syria. It's all about how we can be back to Syria and how we want to be there.
Nobody has like dreamed or planned for this to happen. And like people who in the West can't imagine the horror that happened in Syria. And they just like can compare it with like a natural disaster. And like now it's finished, you can go back. But no, it's not finished. It's not like something happened and it's done. The hurt is still happening. The dictators are still there. And we want to build our countries. We want to be there. But also we needed to be safe to get back.
Wad, you directed this film with Edward Watts. Edward, when did you come into the project? And how would you describe your partnership in putting this film together?
I only got involved in the project after these guys had been forced to flee from Aleppo, and I met Wad for the first time in London. It was only after she left that people realised that she'd gathered this extraordinary archive over 5 years, and it was just hundreds of hours of footage, and I guess everyone felt that it would be good for her to team up with someone who made docs in the past, who also really cared about Syria, because pretty much since the revolution started, I've been talking about Syria. And so really, I saw my role as just someone who would support Wad and Hamza to tell their story in the best way possible, in a way that was completely true and authentic to them, but that would also allow a Western audience that either didn't know anything about Syria or was tired of hearing about Syria, but that would grab them emotionally and engage them with these guys' amazing story.
One of the things that is true about what's happened in Syria is more than 500,000 people have lost their lives. I think for a lot of people around the world, it's impossible to understand the scope of that kind of carnage. And yet, when it becomes specific, when it becomes about one person and a child, I think it becomes more relatable. So is it a specific decision on your part to try to tell this story through your daughter's eyes? And how does that make the story more relatable, do you think?
During shooting the film, I was normal mom. As any mom around the world, I have that specific and private minutes when I was speaking to my child, when I find out that I'm pregnant, and I was speaking to her when she was inside me. All these minutes make me feel that this is kind of the things where the film could be possible for others, moms and parents around the world, to feel more in this situation. And in two-thirds of the process of doing the film with Edward, in that 2 years later, we were thinking about how we can make people more engaged with the story and really reached every house around the world, every parents.
We're talking with Wad and Hamza Al-Khatib and Edward Watts, who with Wad is the director of Forsama. Edward, I want to ask you about some of the footage we see in the hospital. A lot of it is incredibly difficult to watch. It's children who have been killed. They are missing limbs. Were there some things that you felt you couldn't show?
There were two competing impulses here. One was when we first sat together, Wad and I, one of the things that we agreed on, one of our core points was that we had a responsibility to include some of the horror that you see in the film. Because I think in our societies, you know, people are often shielded from those images in the news. And I think that means that they have a sort of disconnect. What is this war? What does war actually look like? What is the effect on human beings? We knew that we had to include some of those images, but equally, we didn't want to alienate our audience or overwhelm them. And we tried to pick images very specifically that would capture the horror, but not be too gruesome or too graphic. And I can tell you there were things that I saw in her footage that I will never forget, that burnt into my mind. And it's just unbelievable to me that these guys saw them with their own eyes.
Well, there's a moment late in the film when you were filming, and there's a mother who I believe has lost a child. She basically tells you, keep filming. This is a moment that is unthinkable. She has lost a child, and she's telling you, don't look away, look at me, and look at what's happening.
It's just about the responsibility that you feel at that time, that these people appreciate what you are doing as one person. Appreciate that the camera is the only thing they feel that it could survive them, because people outside, when they will see this footage, the governments, the other presidents, they will do something for them. These people still believe that people outside will not let them down.
It's never too late for accountability. Maybe not this year, maybe after whatever time. But it's never too late for like bringing justice to those victims.
Wad Al-Khatib and Edward Watts are the directors of the documentary Forsama. Hamza Al-Khatib, Watts' husband, is a subject in the documentary as well. Wad, Hamza, and Edward, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Forsama is in theaters starting today. Coming up on The Frame, Quentin Tarantino's cinematographer Robert Richardson discusses shooting Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Quentin Tarantino's new film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, and Margot Robbie. As the title suggests, the movie feels like a love letter to Los Angeles, iconic locations, sun-drenched cars, and at least a couple of visits to a studio backlot, all set in 1969 and captured on 35mm. The film was shot by longtime Tarantino collaborator Robert Richardson. When Richardson joined me, he first took a few seconds to try his hand as a radio host.
Today in the studio with me, I have Leo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, who are starring at the moment in one of the best films of the year so far, I'd say, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So, Leo, why don't you start first?
How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I want to ask you about shooting your two leading men, Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. You shot Leo before in The Aviator and in Django Unchained. You shot Brad before as well, including Inglourious Basterds. Margot Robbie, I don't think you'd photographed before. And all three of them are playing people who work in Hollywood. They're actors or they're stuntmen. Does that change the way that you shoot them? Because in the story, they're kind of used to being photographed. They're supposed to look good, in other words.
Shooting them, I'm only trying to capture them at the best level in which I am supporting however they're going to act. And the lensing and the lighting is to support that performance of either one of them or either of any that you've mentioned so far. So my goal is to, well, in essence, as I said, I'm a supporter of performance. That's what I have to do.
Leonardo DiCaprio plays a character who is an actor, and there's a moment in the film where he is struggling in his acting. He's having trouble remembering his lines. He doesn't think he's any good. And I'm wondering, in that scene in particular, How much of that really kind of spoke to you about what you've seen on set when an actor is really struggling with his or her performance and kind of starting to have this almost existential crisis about their value?
It's a difficult place to be in as a cinematographer because you're, for myself, I look through the lens. And when I don't like the operating via monitors, which is happening a lot today with digital. I prefer, even with digital, when I do shoot digital, look through an eyepiece as often as I possibly can, because the proximity to an actor and the eyes and the way they perform is vital in terms of not only what I can do in terms of showing support towards them at all times, but also I can speak more readily and with greater accuracy to a director. I believe that sequence is exactly what actors will go back and do in a trailer, of course. Maybe not to the level, but certainly that was, I think, an extraordinarily accurate representation of what Leo must have been feeling when he blew the lines.
There are a lot of shots in this film involving cars, and often those cars are traveling down highways and streets like the Hollywood Freeway and Hollywood Boulevard that have to be dressed, or at least we need to feel as if they're in 1969. So what were those sequences like, and how much of the streets are actually dressed, and how do you make sure that people don't pick up something that doesn't look period?
Well, we avoided everything that wasn't period, like even Hollywood Boulevard. And how can you actually have a movie, by the way, that is in Southern California if you're not driving? Because we're always driving, having to drive everywhere.
Yeah, you guys are moving faster in this movie than you move today, but yes.
Yes, exactly right.
There's no traffic in 1969.
I mean, you got a Hollywood freeway, and what's happening? Well, you only got 80 cars on it. And we shut down. L.A. allowed us to shut down that freeway for 10-minute segments, and we did four or three takes, which was unheard of. I'm sure that L.A. was pondering, why did we say yes? And L.A. was extraordinarily I don't know if they were comfortable, but they were extraordinarily generous in what they did for us.
We're talking with Robert Richardson, the cinematographer on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I want to play a bit of audio from Quentin. He's talking about his relationship with you and how you guys work and your special fondness for shooting things on cranes.
From Django Unchained on, we pretty much never leave the crane. We use the crane like other people use a Steadicam. We use the crane the way other people use dollies. We use the crane to shoot an insert of a spoon.
He's absolutely accurate.
I mean, once you've taken the fucking wall out, why not?
I can think of a couple of really spectacular crane shots in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, especially a shot where the camera kind of travels over the back of a drive-in movie theater marquee. What is it about cranes that you guys like, and what does it give you as a storyteller in this film?
Well, we like the solidity of the crane, and we like the solidity of a dolly move versus what often happens with a Steadicam. Sometimes that's not possible because, obviously, location doesn't allow for it. That particular crane shot that you're referencing with Van Nuys drive-in is actually only part real. The opening is a crane move, moves past it, the car pulls left in front of the Van Nuys, and we begin to boom up. But it was actually finished in a miniature world by John Dykstra. So it looks very real, and the cars look very real because they're all miniature cars as well. So anytime that Quentin has an idea, he wants to do an overhead shot or whatever it might be that requires crane, it's in the truck, which is obviously to his advantage to be able to choose at any time because he comes in usually on the day with 16, 17, 20 shots or whatever it is he wants to accomplish. We don't often know in advance what he wants to do in a particular scene until that moment when he hands over the shot list.
How would you describe the collaboration? Because Quentin obviously spends a lot of time on his screenplays, but he also has a very specific visual language. So how much of what you're shooting on a given day is what Quentin imagines it to be, and how much of it is what you imagine it to be, and how do you find a middle ground about how you're going to pull it off?
Well, there actually is no middle ground with Quentin Tarantino. It is Quentin or it is not. he always sets the shots. He tells me what he wants specifically. He knows his angles. He's thought about it. He's had the script for 5 years. It's in his head. So when he shows up, there is no me trying to convince him or try to find a middle place, because I'm already on his side and I'm attempting only to accomplish what he wants. Every shot is on the script that I'm handed when we began shooting. Every shot.
When you shoot a movie over as long a period as this film was shot, I think it was close to 100 days of 100 days of principal photography, how do you make sure that when you are putting it all together that it all looks the same, that there's continuity in light, in camera? Is that a big challenge? How mindful do you have to be that even though you're shooting over 3 months, it all has to look like it happens in a relatively narrow sequence of real time?
That actually was my greatest challenge and my greatest fear initially when I read the script. Like, how am I going to keep this in that narrow window to look alike and to have all the light feel? And now, with nighttime, you don't have to necessarily worry so much about it, but there was so much daytime in the film. I struggled with that. But fortunately, it weaves three major stories together, or three major characters together, which are Brad, Leo, and Margot, and then also as a fourth weave, I would say, the team of Leo and Brad together. So in some ways it allowed me a freedom, because we weren't always following one character the whole time. But also I would say one of the elements which goes along with that as a character for me would be the soundtrack of KHJ.
This is Batman.
And Robin.
With exclusive news for KHJ listeners.
It's the Batphone Secret Number Contest presented by Boss Radio.
There's a terrific
prize.
Which
was a remarkable soundtrack and also kept you embedded in 1969 due to its being played in every single vehicle you're driving in at any time. So I found that helped my consistency as well, because it kept your mind in another place.
Quentin seems to be particularly interested in feet and shoes and boots in this movie, almost to the point that I was wondering if he had some sort of fetish he was trying to work out. But what were your conversations about shooting people's feet and what they were wearing on their feet?
I didn't actually have a conversation about that. We're all quite accustomed to his foot fetish. There is a love of it. You can see it in Kill Bill. You can see it in Hateful. Any film in between, you're going to see the same sort of movement with feet down low. So the fetish hasn't been worked out yet. We're going to have to let him go on with it. It's part of Quentin's vocabulary.
Let me ask you this last question. Quentin is obviously a very particular filmmaker who has very strong ideas about pretty much everything that happens in his film. What do you enjoy most about being a creative partner in his movies?
I enjoy his passion. His passion for cinema is monumental. The very finest directors I've worked with have the same fire in their belly. And that in particular, I'm going to say Oliver Stone, Martin Scorsese, and Quentin Tarantino. It's a great gift that I was given, an opportunity. I feel extraordinarily fortunate in that matter.
Robert, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. And again, if you don't want to do cinematography, radio beckons.
I will be there, and thank you for having me on the show today.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is in theaters now. Next on The Frame, what's the Michael McDonald background sound? The King of Blue-Eyed Soul explains. Michael McDonald's voice is perhaps one of the most recognizable in pop music. Could be due to his hits with the Doobie Brothers, could also be related to the hip-hop artists who sample his records. But Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett has another theory. Since the mid-1970s, McDonald has performed background vocals on hundreds of recordings by other artists. See if you recognize him in this bit from Steely Dan.
Foreign movie, back to you.
Hello, this is Michael McDonald. You know, that was a kind of an elite group in the L.A. area that I really always felt very proud to be a part of. I got to sing with some pretty great singers, Howard Hewitt, James Ingram, Luther Vandross, Michael Jackson, and I always kind of felt like that was a real feather in my cap to be able to, you know, step up to the mic with those guys. And it was also a great way for me to get in the studio and hear stuff before it was actually released. It's kind of like being a fly on the wall to be a background singer. That's how I got the job with Steely Dan, was working at casuals with some of the guys who were actually playing in the rhythm section on the records and singing backgrounds for those guys on other records that they were doing. I did kind of get used to hearing me sing with myself, and I realized that there's something to that. When the same singer sings all the parts, there's a certain, it's like sibling harmony, you know, you're probably tighter with yourself than anyone else on the planet's going to be, you know, which is what Donald and Walter did with me for the Steely Dan track, Bad Sneakers. You suddenly realize, oh, that's kind of a sound that you probably wouldn't get any other way, but to use the same person singing all the parts and then doubling all the parts, you know. So that was really one of the first times I became keenly aware of that sound, what some people think of as the Michael McDonald background sound. Then on subsequent records, when people were saying, well, how did you get that sound? I could say, well, you know, I did all the parts myself and doubled them. They go, oh, well, let's do that, you know.
We could talk about all those recordings that you were on for a long time, but I just wanted to fast forward a little bit to some of the more recent collaborations that you've done.
Sure. So as you came to make your way. That sounds like Grizzly Bear to me. Yeah, a very unique band, Grizzly Bear, and I really, that came out of the blue. They contacted me, and I had not heard the band, but they sent me a track, and it just was so fresh, you know, and different, and seemingly a band that was really trying to exercise a certain kind of musicality. The bullet on your side, ain't no time to stop it. That's Abner and Amanda and Johnny Swim. Just did that record not that long ago, seemingly, at a house in Santa Barbara where they had kind of camped, set up camp. And Amanda, her mom, was Donna Summer. And I met Amanda when she was about 10 years old. It was the first time I met her. You know, all these years later, I'm singing on records with her.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael McDonald. Wake up and dream. Tell
on the wall. That's my friend Steve Bruner, a.k.a. Thundercat. A great experience. I have to give credit to Kenny Loggins on that one. Kenny's son had heard Steve in an interview kind of mention myself and Kenny as a couple of his influences. His son, you know, was a big fan of Thundercat, as was my daughter at the time. So his son contacted Kenny and said, Dad, you got to call this guy and maybe write something with him, you know. So Kenny kind of reached out to Steve, and Steve got back to us, and we all got together in a studio in Ojai, California, and listened to a bunch of music together, which was great fun. And then we decided to write that tune together. It was something Steve had already started. And so we added our 2 cents, and Steve went and mixed it. On the edge of dark, when no one can tell
their worlds apart, will they ever go? Just a general question. What are you looking for, if anything, in these kinds of collaborations?
I think just a chance to find something that strikes a match for me. And I look in every direction for that, you know, not just new artists and new collaborations with contemporary artists. I still look to the past for a lot of my inspiration, you know. I laid on the bus last night, my headphones on, listening to hours of Curtis Mayfield. He was just, you know, some of those grooves are just so infectious and so wonderful. And his lyrics, of course, are just so stream of conscious and so poignant, you know. Much like the guys like Steve Bruner and Anderson .Paak and Kendrick Lamar, those guys of today, you know, they're just kind of breaking new ground. And he was definitely such a unique voice for modern soul.
Michael McDonald performs at the Hollywood Bowl on July 31st. And that's it for this week. The Frame is produced by the mighty team of Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskett, and Robert Garova. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentina Rivera is the show's engineer, and our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. I'm John Horn. We're back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.